Imagine waking up in a country where every action carries risk, where holding on to hope is an act of rebellion, and where even the simplest routines, cooking dinner, sweeping the floor, driving to the market, can be touched by the shadow of resistance. What would that life be like? At Inside Myanmar Podcast, we're privileged to hear from those who navigate this reality every day, finding ways to persevere, create, and hope despite these immense challenges. Today, we invite you to listen to one such story. Welcome to their world.
Today, my guest is Macheria, and we are going to be looking at a variety of topics focused on the plight of Myanmar women, most of whom are living illegally or at the very least in uncertain legal circumstances in Thailand. We're going to be examining the Marxist feminist perspective on the labor struggles that have been taking place within Myanmar even before the coup, and obviously the negative impacts of the coup and the post-coup conflict period has had on the opportunities of workers, and again, particularly of women. But before we get into all of those, Macheria, thank you very much for joining us. And I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and tell a little bit about your background and your experiences for our audience.
Okay, thank you, and thanks for having me here. So I'm Macheria, and I'm a labor researcher from Myanmar. Currently, I'm based in Thailand, Chiang Mai. So currently, I'm a research fellow at Chiang Mai University, and my research is related with the migrant labor in border areas like May South Thailand. And I particularly look at the struggles of the women workers, especially in the informal factories or the home-based factories. And I particularly look from the Marxist feminist perspectives. And in addition to that, I'm closely engaging with the other labor unions and also the ethnic women organizations. And I have them like to conduct the gender and feminism training are with them. And thanks for having me here.
It's our pleasure. I want to start by sort of looking at your experiences and what brought you to where you are now. So can you tell us, what were you doing before the coup?
So before the coup, like I might say, like I'm a social worker and I work with the like non-profit organizations are focusing on the informal peace bathing sector and also the gender related work. And before the in the beginning of the military coup, like I joined the nationwide strikes, and when the military cracked when the military crackdown started in March 2020, when I joined the flash mob strikes with other, you know, comrades from the general strikes committees, and also the along with my comrades at the general township strike committee members, and then I came to Thailand in 2022, and then I studied master art and public policy at Chiang Mai University.
And so I wonder, I sort of wonder about this. When you say you went to Thailand, What motivated that move? Did you go to Thailand because you didn't have education opportunities within Myanmar and because you wanted to examine the status of Burmese women abroad? Or did you feel that you had to flee from the military and from the police as a result of your activism?
So as mentioned before, like I joined the flash mob strikes along with my comrades, and so like in early 2022, the situation is getting worse, and like my comrades and we can no longer like contact or organize the this kind of flash mob strikes, and some of my comrades also, they got arrested. So I decided like to come to Thailand and also to pass through my education. And also I believe that like by living in Thailand, I can more, you know, get involved in the anti-military struggles and the and pro-democracy movement. So like instead of living inside the country, I feel like my contributions will be more like significant, so I can do more contributions by living in Thailand. So that is why I decided to live and stay in Thailand.
Excellent. So then let's look at what's going on in Thailand. Of course, the diaspora community exists in many different places, and the informal labor sector exists in many places, but I think Thailand is probably the largest destination for refugees from Myanmar. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that is true. Like according to the IOM, like they have an estimated number, and as of October 2024, like there are 4.1 million migrants who are from Myanmar, and they are also like undocumented migrants and undocumented workers, and their estimated number is around like 1.8 million. And I think that situation is getting more difficult due to the conscription law and also the more political oppression from the military junta.
Did you say 4.5 million?
4.1 million. Yeah.
Really? That's it. Like, the population of Myanmar is only about, 53 million people before the coup. Mm-hmm. So that's potentially close to 10% of the entire population of the country.
That is true. Like, you know, since like this, before the Supreme Revolution, like there is also a mass migration from Myanmar side too, because due to the like long lasting conflicts inside the country, and also the 2008 cyclone Nargis. Also, that is why like these kinds of factors, they are contributing to like you know, mass migration to Thailand, like things before the coup. Yeah.
There's still an enormous population to have in Thailand. And I think the first question that should be raised in this situation is that when you have such a large population, do they have their own internal economy? Because if you have, you know, places like Mae Sot, even Chiang Mai have enormous Myanmar populations, it would be conceivable that they would establish their own little zones, their own areas where they predominantly do economic activities, and that they could make a living trading back and forth and creating their own sub economy within Thailand. Does that sort of situation ever eventuate?
Like, you know, we can see like in particularly in Mae Sot, we can see like this began like more for the Burmese populations, and also like even the Thai citizens, they also speak the, you know, Burmese language. And that situation is like, it is obvious that Thailand relies on the migrants' labor, but that thing is what the migrant workers, what they have to do in Thailand is like very, you know, dangerous. And we call it like 3D jobs, like dangerous, the mini and also very dirty job, which the local citizens don't want to do. So it means that like the migrant workers, they have to do the like this low paid jobs by contributing to the Thai economy. And also, like, most of them, they also had to rely on the agents and the other brokers, like, to pass through the through the border. And also I'm also did other collaborative research with my comrade or the professor from Singapore, and the work is about the migrant fishers in Rannam region. So we can also see that in Rannam region there are also a lot of the Burmese migrants, and they had to work on the fishing boat, which normally the Thai citizens don't want to work.
Mm. And I know, just on that point, I know that historically in Thailand, there has been a lot of abuse in the fishing industry. I know that there have been very serious reforms that mm-hmm. have taken place over the last few years. The Thai government has responded, but we saw many instances of human trafficking, of enslavement, of abuse, even workers dying or being killed by these criminal enterprises that run illegal fishing operations. Many of which go down to Malaysia and Indonesia to fish illegally in foreign waters. Is it the case that the Burmese workers are being taken in to fill those types of positions now that the Thai government is putting more effort into protecting Thai citizens from abuses within the fishing industry?
Yeah, that is true. Like, also this fishing sector, it is very notorious for the human rights violations. And these days, even though there are like some reforms conducted by the Thai government, but the situations also stay bad. So the workers in the fishing boat, they have to live in the precarious living conditions. They have to work the long hours. They receive the low pay, and also there is a high risk of the human rights violations on the boat, and also there is the forced labor and also death bondage, and the workers, they cannot freely choose the employers too, because there is a difference between the Mae Sot and Rannam region, because like in Mae Sot and in the employers, they employ the undocumented workers, in my case, the informal factories or the home-based factories. Mm-hmm. But in the fishing boat sector in the Rannam region, the employers, they only employ the workers who have the documentation, who have the complete documentation. This is also related with the their recent reform in this fishing sector too. But the danger is their workers, they cannot freely choose the employers, because once they receive the documents, the employers, they tend to confiscate the documents of the workers. So yeah, so the situation in fishing sector is we can say that it is not that improving. And the recent conscription law in Myanmar also has a huge impact on this fishing sector too. These days, the employers, whenever the the fishers, they complain about the rights violations of the precarious situations on the boat, what they said is you can go back to your country if you don't want to if you don't want to be employed anymore or things like that. So yeah. I found out such kind of the very sad stories when I did the interview with the fishers and also the labor organizations when I did free visits in Rannam.
I'm not surprised at all to hear this. I also want to talk about the agents and the brokers that you talk about. It's very normal, very common in conflict situations or situations when a country is unstable, that you have these groups and these individuals who take money to take people across the border. And there are a lot of different ways in which this can be done. And I'm wondering if you can shed a little bit of light on this, because in some instances, these brokers, we can call them people smugglers, in a lot of contexts, in some cases they accept the money and they will take you across the border, and that's the end of that relationship. But there are, of course, a lot of other circumstances where we hear, you know, people being taken across the border, but they lose their phones, they lose their passports, and they're kept as slaves, or they're taken across the border, they can't pay, and they say, well, then you have to work for me when you go across the border and work on my farm and so on. What type of circumstances do Burmese people face when they enlist a broker or an agent or a people smuggler or whatever to get them across the border?
Yeah, so the workers, they have to rely on the brokers or the agents. Like it's also common since before the military coup in Myanmar, because like if I'm not mistaken, the MOU was signed between two countries like Thai and Myanmar. I think it was in 2003 or 2004, I'm not sure. But even though like there is an MOU for the to regulate the migration regime in Thailand, but the MOU process is not that practical for workers, because like the first thing, it takes time a lot, and also workers have to spend their workers have to pay much. So most of the workers, they don't like it, because like if you go through with the MOU process, like you have to pass through the many bureaucratic procedures, and so it takes time a lot. So since that time, most of the workers, they rely on the like brokers and the agent, and some of them, they don't have like they have no enough information about the this migration procedure. So after the military coup, like it is getting worse, because like brokers, they can also it means that the brokers, they have the more tendency to exploit the like workers, and but in renowned situation, like migration to Thailand is happens through the like more kinship relationships rather than the like reliance on the brokers. But in other parts of the Thailand, like in May South or Chiang Mai, like reliance on the broker or the agent is more common. Yeah.
And I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, because I think it's a very interesting label, and it's a very, very important point to raise: the three B's. So you're talking about jobs which are dangerous, jobs which are demeaning, and jobs which are dirty. And of course, there's this truism. We often say, well, migrants fill the jobs that we don't want to do. That's something that we hear a lot in the Western world. But I think it's very important that the jobs we don't want to do sounds very gentle. And the truth, as you say, is that these are the jobs which are physically dangerous, or these are the jobs which are or psychologically dangerous, and the jobs which are demeaning and are judged by society as very negative jobs, and the jobs that are very dirty and very filthy and sort of offensive to the senses. And people have to rely on these types of jobs to get by. So I do wonder, can you give some examples of the typical types of these 3D jobs that the Myanmar expatriate population would be forced into doing? And what are the consequences of working in these types of industries while living in Thailand?
Yeah, so when we talk about this 3D jobs, like it is common in like informal factories, which I conducted research. Also, like it is also obvious in the fishing sector too, because when I did the like interview, I met Wen Fisher. He is originally from Karen, and he can be considered like long-term migrant, and he has been doing on the same boat for the many years. But when I met him, like he almost lost his vision, eye vision, because he got the like accident when he was on the fishing boat. And but the employers and the also the translators, they didn't take responsibility for him. So when he is when he goes see a doctor at the hospital, there is also like barriers for him, because he cannot speak Thai, and also he doesn't understand well about the Thai language. So when I met him, like he almost lost his eye vision, and he's also like jobless. And also the situation is like very sad. And also there are also like a lot of the other dead cases and also human rights violations on the boat. So we can see like such kind of 3D jobs which, you know, the migrant workers, they have to fill in because apparently like the citizens, they don't want to work in that sector. Also, like it is also common in the home-based factories or the informal factories too, because in the like home-based factories or the informal factories, it means like these factories, they are not registered, so they can abide the taxation, you know, for the Thai government. So now, like, the minimum wage for the formal factory is around 352 Thai baht, minimum wage. But if you work in the informal factories of the home-based factories, you just receive the, you just get the 180 to 200 Thai baht. And also the working hours are also very prolonged too. So it is very obvious that, you know, the Thai citizens, they don't want to work or they don't want to fail in that kind of situation. But migrant workers, they have to work in that sector and they have to fail such kind of the, you know, 3D jobs.
And so this is something that I find very interesting, because this informal sector, it still pays money. And of course, we hear about all of these very horrific cases where people are effectively forced to work for no compensation, right? Whether this is slavery, whether this is debt bondage, whether this is some other, you know, variation on the same basic idea, people are being forced to work for nothing. But from what I understand of your work, the majority of the Myanmar people living in Thailand are not living in situations where they are working for no payment whatsoever. They are receiving payment, but as you noted here, the informal sector is paying approximately half of the minimum wage. And I don't know how Thai factories are. Would the minimum wage in a Thai factory, a formal Thai factory, would the minimum wage be common, or would they likely pay a little bit more than that?
Well, so like in the formal factories, they have to like comply with the minimum wage. So which is like current, the minimum wage is 352. But like in some cases or in some scenarios, there are also cases where workers in the formal factories, they don't, you know, get fully page two, but in the informal sectors, like it is, workers know that it is very unfair, but they cannot like do any complaints because they are undocumented. So if they went to, you know, find a complaint to the police or the, you know, Thai labor organizations, it is, of course, there will be like a lot of the blackface against them, because the first thing is they are undocumented. So, but workers, they choose to be employed in the informal factories. This is also because of their documentation status. Another thing is like, unlike the formal factories, in the informal factories, they provide the same like flexible working criteria, because like in the formal factories, the recruitment criteria is very rigid and you have to, you know, you must have the like full documentations. But in the informal factories, they also recruit the undocumented workers, and also they allow the workers to look after their children, which is not common in the like formal factories. And also another thing is, according to my interviews with the workers in the formal factories, like barrier harassment is very common, but in the informal factories, like workers, they can, you know, the working environment is not that cruel compared to the like formal factories. This is also because like in the informal factories, workers are like being paid not based on the minimum wage, but based on the like production pieces or the pieces they produce. So it means like in the formal factories, the employers, they have to comply with the minimum wage. So what they did is like to encourage their workers or to urge the workers to produce more. But in the informal factories, the employers careless about the like their production targets because workers are not being paid based on the minimum wage, but based on the like pieces they produce. So I also want to highlight the quote from the labor organization. So this labor organization mentioned that, you know, the employers, they have nothing to lose. So they don't care much about the like how much their workers produce in the informal factories.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting to hear that it almost seems that there are certain aspects where the informal factories have advantages over the formal factories, which is, again, not something that we would think about, not something that we would consider. But let's sort of look at some of the other differences between them. And let's start with safety. Do you see a measurable difference in the safety precautions and the general level of danger in the factories themselves between the formal and the informal factories?
Yeah, that is also like good to highlight that part too, because in the formal factories, like they are like, you know, some precautionary measures, and also there is also a first aid you know, kit inside the factories. But in the informal factories, it is not you know, there is no first aid kit. And also when the employers, when the workers, when they got injuries on the machine, they don't get like a proper treatment too, but workers, they cannot like complain about such kind of the situations in the like informal factories. Yeah.
Mm. Another one is the working hours. I would imagine that because, as you say, in the formal factories, there is a minimum wage, and in the informal factories, they're working per unit that they produce. Does this drive people in the informal sector to work particularly long hours compared to people who work in the formal sector?
I think working hours like won't be such you know, different, because in the informal factories, like workers, they also have to work overtime. But the thing is, like, they are very irregular working hours. But in the formal factories, like, they also have to work the prolonged hours. But we can say, like, you know, that they are like regular, you know, working hours, including the overtime. But in the informal factories, like there are some flexible working hours. But when there are, you know, increased orders from the manufacturer's side, workers, they have to work overtime. So prolonged working hour is also common, like in the informal factories.
Okay, interesting to hear that. And so this is going to be a little bit of a detour because I want to talk about sort of labor unions. I want to talk about collective action. And in order to fully understand this, I think it's going to be useful for us to jump back. And can you take us through a bit of the history with regards to collectivized labor and labor unions in Myanmar? I know, you know, we could go all the way back to the early 1900s. And there were very famous uprisings and pushback against abuses of the workers and abuses of the farmers. But under the let's say pseudo democratic government after 2010 and 2015, I understand the situation was improving in Myanmar. Did we have a strong and strengthening labor union that was able to successfully advocate for workers' rights and for increases to minimum wage and safety and conditions and things like this?
So we can say, like, before the coup, especially like the garment sector or the manufacturing sector, it is very you know, well known for its militant labor actions in this particular sector. And also, it is true that after the, you know, when the semi-civilian government came to power, Thein-Sein government came to power, there are like a lot of the economics and labor reform projects too. So in 2010, like the government, they passed the labor law in 2010, and which legalized the formation of the trade unions in Myanmar. So in sorry, in 2011, they first delivered or labor law and which legalized the trade union formation in Myanmar. And also because of that process, like there are a lot of the militants labor actions inside the country, especially in the manufacturing sector. And also the worker strikes are also very, you know, well known during that process too. But after the military coup, these workers, they also, you know, in the front line by organizing the like nationwide strike. And so because of that, sister labor unions and also other labor organizations are declared illegal. So along with that, like there are a lot of the union vesting and also political oppression against the workers. And sometimes like the employers, they also tend to take advantage of the political turmoil to oppress the workers. So the situation between after the military coup and before the military coup is like very different too.
Interesting. And so this is the issue with the military coup. Those who would remember 2021, of course, we saw early, I think around March, massive fires in Haindaya, a very important industrial zone in Yangon. This is something that we've spoken about on this podcast many times. It was covered in the media quite a bit. And the factories were being burned. And there was a lot of commentary at the time that this was because, well, the factories are owned by Chinese companies and the Burmese people wanted to send a message to China and things like this. And ultimately it transpired that the real motivation was that the workers were angry and they were scared that under a military regime, all of the progress that they had made over the last 10 years with regards to, you know, collectivized bargaining, labor unions, things like this, would be wiped and they would fall back and they would be making less money and working longer hours in a country where now prices were increasing. And so what I'm wondering about with regards to this is there any type of push for collectivized bargaining or labor formation, union formation, sorry, in these informal factories in Thailand? Obviously, the Burmese there are in a very precarious position. It's very dangerous for them, but there are a lot of the Burmese and the factories are dependent on them. Have you heard of any examples of unionization or the beginnings of unionization within the informal sector?
Yeah, so so like according to like my research experience, it is very difficult for the workers, especially in the informal sectors, to, you know, do the collective bargaining or the you know, to organize the to organize the labor, especially for the like informal factories, because like it is also still difficult for workers in the formal factories too to participate in the collective bargaining and also to do the labor organizing, because there is a you know, labor law in Thai which indicates that migrant workers, they cannot organize their own labor unions. Instead, they have to join the unions organized by the Thai workers or the Thai citizens. But even though there is a law, the situation is very impractical, because like in May South and also the like other border areas in like right now, you know, they are, you know, less number of the Thai citizens who are working in the, you know, same factories. So it's even though there is a law, you know, which permit that migrant workers, they can join the unions organized by the Thai citizen, but it is very impractical for Myanmar workers, even in the like formal formal factories. So in the informal factories, it is very difficult, because the first thing is workers, they don't have any documents. So even though workers are very aware of the labor exploitations and other unfair treatment committed by the employers of their supervisors, they cannot do any complaints. So labor organizing is, I mean, will difficult for them in the informal factories.
I mean, that's obviously very reasonable and a very common situation. And this sort of leads me to a sort of larger scope. with regards to Burmese taking back control of this, it's obviously going to be very difficult because, as we've been discussing, they live in irregular situations, they're undocumented. But is there any possibility, any scope for the Burmese to become business owners within Thailand to somehow establish their own entities? And within that as well, I think the most important sector would be agriculture, because at the end of the day, people have to eat. And if there were Burmese ownership within Thailand of farms that could produce food, then that, I think, or at least this is my estimation, it would bring a lot of stability to the lives of a lot of the Burmese people who have to depend on Thai businesses to survive, and they're always running that risk that the Thai businesses are not going to deal with them, are not going to treat them fairly, and so on. So is there any scope for, or anything on the horizon for the Burmese to take ownership of businesses, or to establish businesses of their own and hire other Burmese?
Yeah, so like before I did the interview with these undocumented workers, there is some existing research which indicate that they can also be employers who are Myanmar citizens, especially in this, the informal factories. But when I did the interview, these workers, like what they mentioned is most of the owners in these informal factories, they are like Myanmar, they are like Thai citizens, and they live in like urban centers like Bangkok or the Chiang Mai. So maybe like there is a possibility of, you know, where Burmese own the business and who they can hire the Myanmar workers. But I think that might be also very difficult to own the business in Thailand situation as well, because there are a lot of the regulation projects to pass through. And also, I think there is a possibility, but it is very difficult for the, you know, Myanmar or other citizens to own the business.
I mean, it's sort of a question that I suspected the answer to, but there's always that hope that there's a pathway out. That said, you know, thus far, obviously, we've been discussing a very generalized situation of migrants in general. But of course, your focus is specifically on women. And very often, when we do this analysis and we look at refugee communities, we look at irregular communities, we look at undocumented communities, we tend to sort of lump everyone into the same bucket, and we don't look at the differences between different demographics within that community. So to start us off, can you sort of give us a bit of an insight into the differences that women in this situation in Thailand would face compared to the men, the additional difficulties and the additional hardships and dangers?
Yeah, so this is what my research particularly look at. So like so mainly like I approach from the Marxist feminist perspectives. So if we talk about the like Marxist feminism or the social revolution feminism, we also have to like some theoretical aspects. And so like this Marxist feminism, it was founded by the Marxist feminists, and they apparently begin with the silence in Marxism, because like when Marx talk about the exploitation and other capitalism, he talks about the how capitalist class you know, exploit the workers' labor and things like that. But what he neglected is the about how the patriarchy system or the patriarchy you know, values can also influence that such gender division of labor, and how it can also impose the double burden on the women. So basically, like Marxist feminists, they talk about the like how capitalism and the patriarchy are interrelated to each other. So we can say that like social reproduction theory, it mainly concerns with reproduction of the like labor power, which refers like not only to the biological reproduction, but also like reproducing the workers through food, shelter, and other emotional support, which are fundamentally important for the wage work. So in my research, like I integrated this Marxist feminist approach. So when I did the like interview, we can say like in the informal factories or there in the garment sector, there are 70% of women are 70% of workers are women, but also they are like male workers too. So in my case, like in the informal factories, like there are some cases where both, you know, husbands and wife, they are working in the same factory. There are some cases like that too. But the difference is like women workers, they have to, you know, perform most of the household jobs, and which are also neutralized after women duty. So let's say like both husband and wife, they work in the same factory, but when they get back to their dormitory or their, you know, accommodation or their place, why women workers, when they have to, why they have to do the household jobs and also the childcare jobs, what the male workers do is like, you know, taking a rest, even though like they spend the same working hours inside the factory. So such kind of the gender experience is also different between the male workers and the female workers. And also they also documentation status, when there is also a tendency or there is also a cases of time authorities who committed the sexual violence against the against the women workers too. And even like in the same factory, in the formal factories or the informal factories, there is also cases like their male colleague committed the sexual violence against the their fellow female workers. So we can see like such kind of the gender experience are also common in the in massage situation too.
And I mean, on the topic of things like gender-based violence, is there any recourse? Because obviously all of these people are living in the country undocumented. Do they have the opportunity to report gender-based violence to the police? Or is that just going to make the situation worse? And are they facing, you know, deportation or being forced to pay bribes?
Yeah. So when we talk about the like gender-based violence, like in the cases of the former factories, like they, where the women workers, like they can report their cases to the police or the like labor departments. But for the informal factories or for the undocumented workers, they can rarely report, especially to the police or the to the labor department. So instead, what they did is like there are some, you know, labor organizations like Yang Jiu and also the American Workers Organization in May South, and they are found with the Burmese people. So in the case of the informal factories, they're workers, they go to the like these organizations rather than reporting their cases to the police. So sometimes like their cases are resolved like by negotiation. And also the important thing is their cases are these cases happen like between the like wife and husband, or you know, between two lovers or two partners or things like that. So most of the cases are resolved by the like negotiation between the respective parties.
Fair enough. So it's good that there is at least some mechanism that that they can go to, but it is definitely lacking. So I want to come back to the Marxist feminism, just because I find it very interesting to listen to you talking about this, bringing it back to the ideology and the theory direct from Marx. So you were talking about the double exploitation. So I just wanted to double check. So when you're talking about double exploitation, you are talking about the use of women both laboring in a conventional capitalist context and then subsequently also laboring in the home context, correct?
Yeah, that is true. Like because like let's say about under the rise of the neoliberal capitalism or capitalism, everyone has to work, so women have to work too. So their labor in the production sphere is also exploited, but in the domestic sphere, they also have to perform this kind of the, you know, unpaid work, which include the like childcare and also household, you know, domestic labor and also other, you know, elderly care too, which are clearly unpaid. So what Marxist feminists find out is that capitalism not only exploit the labor in the production sphere, but also the labor in the social reproduction sphere of the domestic sphere. So apparently, like, the unpaid labor in the social reproduction sphere is need to be performed by women. Also, it is also naturalized as the women's duty. This is because of the, like, gender division of labor under the patriarchal system, because patriarchal system makes us believe that this labor, women have to perform this labor to be like good mother or, you know, good housewife or stuff like that. So what Marxist feminists find out is that how capitalism and patriarchy are interrelated to each other. When capitalism free right the unpaid labor in the social reproduction sphere, patriarchy system also support that. It makes it blind, you know, the labor, this unpaid work women have to do is at a value or it is, you know, normal duty for women. Yeah.
Mm. And so this, what is fascinating about Marxist feminism is because obviously Marxism concerns itself very greatly with the nature of capitalism and the inherent exploitation that exists within a capitalist framework. And feminism naturally tends to towards the examination of patriarchy and the intrinsic harm that comes from a patriarchal system. And so sitting at the intersection of these two ideologies, do you feel that capitalism and patriarchy are intrinsically interlinked? That if we have one, we are naturally going to have the other? Or do you believe that it is possible to separate these two things out and have a non-patriarchal capitalism or have a non-capitalist patriarchy?
So I'm not only me, but also like other, you know, feminists or the Marxist feminists or intersectional feminists, what they pointed out is that like these two systems, they cannot be seen as separate because they are like related to each other. If there is a capitalism, is it they also like a patriarchal system? Is it so? What Marxist feminists pointed out is that like in the revolution, we have to abolish like both of these systems together, like not separately, because they are, you know, intersected and they are completely related to each other.
Mm. And this sort of comes back to something that we saw earlier. So if we go back to 2021, 2022, when we saw a lot of Burmese cultural norms, patriarchal cultural norms, again, things that we have discussed multiple times on the podcast, but the Tameng Kantat, looking at, you know, the prohibition on the part of the military from coming into contact with women's clothing or anything to do with menstruation or just generally this sort of belief in pone as almost an antithetical force to femininity. And then of course we saw youth in the Gen Z challenging this directly by wearing tameng to sort of ridicule the military's belief in these sorts of systems. It does seem that there has been significant progress made with regards to the recognition of the feminist cause and a recognition of the historical entrenched patriarchal beliefs within Burmese society. But of course, we've also interviewed multiple people on this podcast who have said that despite that progress, it's very little in the scheme of things. And I wonder whether the Burmese who are living in these situations in Thailand, the people that you have spoken to, the people you've done your research with, do you find that they are more motivated to move away from these patriarchal norms and societal norms because, you know, they're living in this situation where they have to struggle and they have to find new solutions to a very uncomfortable reality? Or does it cause them to sort of double down and fall back even harder into the patriarchal norms that were taught to them when they were children?
Yeah, so like I think it is very like difficult to analyze the, you know, the whole situation, but personally I believe that like there is a progress, like, you know, in the past most of us know we are not familiar with what feminism is or what, you know, gender concepts are, but there is a progress like in terms of the ideological perspectives, but I don't believe that there is a progress in the like predicts or the practical level, because even in the, you know, like some revolutionary forces, there are also some cases about the gender-based violence and also, you know, some patriarchal narratives patriarchal narratives among these, you know, revolutionary groups. So there is not that much progress at the like practical level, but this day most of the people or most of the, you know, women organizations, they find a more space to talk about this, you know, gender things in the ongoing revolution. And also I think it is also important to look at the current political landscape too, because currently we are undergoing an armed struggle. So we know that armed struggle of the militarism is always associated with the masculinity and the sexism. So there is also a like militarized patriarchy thing too. So I think there has been some progress to some extent in terms of the like ideological level, but there has to be like more progress at the, you know, practical level too. So in addition to that, what I feel is like personally, when we talk about the like feminism or the, you know, gender thing, the narratives are more common between the like, you know, some, you know, class, like educated and also some sort of the groups who have access to the internet or things like that. So we also need to separate the ideas at the like, you know, ground level too. We also have to integrate more you know, class perspectives and also the, you know, intersectional perspectives in the dialogue too. And we need such kind of the, you know, considerations when we talk about the like gender and the feminism. Also, in the meanwhile, like there are some, you know, online platforms where they advocate for the like women's issues and feminism issues and also queer issues. Like they are also like producing or presenting the many interesting articles and the dialogues and the interviews too, which are very rare in the past. But we can see like such kind of arrangements we can consider as a progress, like at the, you know, ideological level or the ideological, you know, sphere. Yeah.
We want to highlight a case that arose and that should give us a little bit of illumination on the human element of all of the things that we've been discussing predominantly in the abstract and the ideological up until now.
Yeah, so I just want to like highlight about the case of the arrest of director of the STUM, Solidarity Trade Union of Myanmar, Dong Myu Myu A, and the other 9 STUM members. So in like July 2025, the military regime, they arrested Dong Myu Myu A and other 8 STUM members. And actually, Dong Myu Myu A was also arrested in April 2021, and she was in prison for 6 months, and so this is her second time. So I think it is also very interesting to mention like how STUM was established in the first place. So STUM, Solidarity Trade Union Myanmar, was founded in 2016 due to this satisfaction with the same male-dominated union culture and also the patriarchal practices of the union. So actually, like we all know that the government said that they employing like 90% of women workers, but when it comes to the like labor unions, there were like some, you know, patriarchal practices within the union, and most of the decision makings were done by the male unionists. So Dong Myu Myu A and other female workers, they decided to form this STUM, and they did a very great job since before the coup, and also like after the military coup, WWE got arrested because of her involvement in the anti-military regime. And even though, like, despite the political oppression and the military crackdown against the workers, WWE and STUM, they decided to remain inside the country, and they decided to have the workers, like, to assess the collective bargaining and other dispute resolution mechanism. And they did a very great job, but July 2025, she got arrested again. And I think it is very important to mention her case. Yeah.
So what do we know about these arrests? Obviously, the circumstances in Myanmar are pretty bad. Was this driven purely by, you know, a local police force just, you know, wanting to get rid of some troublemakers, or is this more endemic? Is this emblematic of a concentrated effort across the country to crack down on labor union movements?
So, like, there are some local news. According to some local news, like, arrest of WWE and STUM is connected with some particular factory. But I think it might be also the case. But also, like, sometimes, like, most of the people tend to see the labor movement in Myanmar as apolitical. But I don't feel like labor movement is, you know, apolitical at all. And they are, like, you know, some political substance as well, because they are opposing against the military junta and also against the, like, ruling class, which means, like, empires. So I think the labor movement in Myanmar was never apolitical at all. So I think there can be, you know, some connections related with the, like, anti-regime sentiments as well. Also, like, what WWE was doing is also, they are also pressuring the, like, international banks, because, like, sometimes, like, employees, they care less, they don't care much about the workers' demands, or also, like, the regime as well. They don't care much about the workers' continuous demand. But when they get the pressure from the international banks, they pay, you know, a little attention to. It was also very evident, according to the same cases of the strikes in post-coup situation as well. So I think it can also be, like, there are some connections, not only about this particular factory, but also about the, you know, her ongoing labor activism inside the country. Yeah.
And do we know what happened to her after she was arrested?
According to the, like, latest information, she and other STU members, they are staying in custody. And also, one thing is, like, she has a medical situation, like, she has diabetes, but there is still a, like, lack of access to the anti-diabetes medications. And so this is all the, like, according to the latest information. But the reason behind her arrest and what we have been is still unknown to the labor community and us. Yeah.
And I mean, this is the difficult question. I mean, more broadly than the implications for labor unions, just the difficulty of accessing justice and accessing legal representation. Have the arrested STUM members, as far as you know, been given access to lawyers? Do they have legal representation? Do they have cases pending? Have they been able to communicate with friends and family outside of the prison?
I'm not sure about that, but, like, some charges against the STUM is also related with the, like, you know, registration process as well. So I'm not sure like whether they have, you know, like some lawyers to represent them or not, but it is very clear that in the, you know, post-coup situation, the another military regime, like human rights defenders and also the freedom of speech and also including the labor movement, they are like being oppressed seriously another military regime. I think it is very obvious. Yeah. Mm. And also like, you know, lack of access to the justice as well.
Yes. And of course, for coming back to our sort of recurring theme on the Marxist feminism, so STUM exists in sort of opposition to, I mean, maybe that's a little bit of an aggressive word, but it exists to counterbalance the Myanmar Trade Union Federation, MTUF, which they would argue is very male dominated and therefore does not accurately does not effectively advocate for the needs and the rights of women within the labor force. The question then becomes, by contrast, how has the MTUF been treated by the regime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, you know, she also has a like strong character and like, you know, due to the patriarchal practice of these labor unions, like women have like limited access to the decision making labor, even though like most of the workers in the factories are women. So yeah,
you actually participate in training for ethnic women's organizations, if I'm correct, discussing these very same things. You're talking about gender and you're talking about feminism and patriarchy and all of these problems and raising awareness for this. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is involved in this type of training that you do, and what is the intended outcome of this training?
I conducted this training like online, but I went to do it like in person, but it is impractical for me because I had to go to the like this, you know, particular ethnic control area. So I just conducted online, and I believe that like such kind of the, you know, feminism training or the gender training, it is better if we conduct them in like in person rather than online, because there are a lot of the dialogue and the discussions to be made, because we cannot like teach the feminism, but we just have to learn, or we just have to reflect our lived experience of the, you know, to connect with the like other you know, people experience. And so if we talk about the feminism training or the gender training, we need to be conducted like that, but I have to do that online. So in the like training sessions, I share the many numerous ideas, as you mentioned, like basic ideas about the gender and gender theories, and also about the queer theories, and also patriarchy and how patriarchy is evolved. And also I also included the feminism and various ideologies of the feminism, like liberal feminism, intersectional feminism, Marxist feminism, radical feminism, and concepts like that. So what I did is like, I don't want to go like, you know, a top-down approach, like I'm the speaker, you are the listener, or I'm the teacher, you are the students. No, not like that. So what I did is like, I let them, you know, to read some articles, because as mentioned, like there are many social media platforms called Revolution 1.0 and The Bomb, which is known as Rebel in English. And they produce or they present very interesting and very insightful articles and essays, and which are based on the like interviews with the women in the refugee camps and women in the, you know, Enya areas and the women in the ethnic control areas. So I let the participants to read them and let them to discuss about them. And then in the main session, I discuss with them again. And there is also a dialogue and also very insightful and very fruitful discussions, I believe. And there are also like questions and the answer. And based on the discussions, I share the like theoretical concepts with them. And sometimes I also invite the like other, you know, feminists and labor organizers in the session, and they talk about their experience, especially like from the feminist perspectives. And also, I think that is good because rather than listening to my, you know, opinions only, the participants, they can also learn about the ideas who are actually doing a great job at the ground and by engaging with the people on the ground. So yeah, this is what I did with these, ethnic women organizations.
And do you ever, this is what I wonder, do you have follow-ups with these organizations? Because I'd be very curious to know what the impact of this type of training is. I know that there are many different groups that do this type of training. And as a result of this type of training, women in these communities are more aware, they are more able to stand up for their rights, they're more able to push back against exploitation by men. And it leads to a higher level of equity within that community. I just wondered, do you follow up with any of these communities to see what impact the training has had?
So like, even though like I have the close relationships with them and I'm still like provided the ongoing support to these organizations and their, you know, associated groups, but that didn't just like, when we talk about the like feminism or the gender, like, the impacts are very, they take time, right? They take time. So it's very, like, very rare to see the, like, immediate impact. So even though, like, there is a, like, follow up and the, close contact with them, we cannot, like, dig into, like, many, impacts, but, they are also like currently doing a very important job on the ground, like in the village level. So I think even though the immediate impacts are still hard to see or still hard to follow up, but I think their concepts, they, you know, get a very important, and it might, you know, be a big contribution to their, you know, ongoing activism or to their ongoing work.
And I know you said you deliver this in a variety of different areas and you're teaching it online. I'm just wondering, again, coming back to the topic of the Myanmar community who's living over the border in Thailand, is there any sort of difference in what you feel you need to teach and what you feel you need to discuss when you're trying to give this type of training and education to women's communities within Myanmar, within their own, you know, let's say historical traditional territories, and communities that have had to flee across the border?
So especially like in the border areas, like the dangers, I think especially in the informal factories workers, most of them like they don't know much about the like labor rights, and also like they don't know much about the like gender concepts too, because when we talk about the gender-based violence between the husband and the wife, sometimes like their cases are less obvious because sometimes women workers they fail to complain them because they don't see it like there is the problem, or men beating women is, you know, considered as normal for them. So I think it's still important to, you know, separate such kind of the concepts, including the like labor rights, surgery labor rights concepts among these groups too. But it is very difficult for them like to assess such kind of the concepts because they are already living in the like precarious working conditions without, you know, with limited assets. So yeah.
Fair enough. And just on the last topic on this, because you say they have limited access and they have limited opportunities, I wonder if there's anything you can speak with regards to what I would call the resiliency strategies of women living in these conditions over the border in Thailand. Is there anything that you've noticed that women have been able to do, or any way in which women have been able to rise to meet the obstacles and the challenges and the difficulties and the dangers that they face in this new context that helps them to stay more safe and that helps them to stay more successful?
So I believe that it might be very difficult for them, like to find a better way or to find a good way, especially after the, you know, in the post-COVID situation. Because when I interview, I also met the same people who are, you know, who joined the CDM movement, civil disobedience movement, and they are also currently employed in the informal factories. And some of them, like, they know that, you know, what the employers do or what the translators do to them is very unfair, and it is unfair, but they cannot do like any complaint, or, you know, they cannot leave the job, because if they get deported to the country, they might have like end up in jail because of their, you know, CDM involvement in CDM movement. So the situations in the, like, you know, Mesa contest in Thailand, especially in the informal sector contest, it is very difficult for them. Also, like, as mentioned, like, the wages they get are very low. So it is, you know, inadequate for them to survive, given upon the, you know, the prices, the price increased prices of the accommodations and everything in, you know, Mesa contest. And also another thing, just like for their children, like, to access the education system, Thai public education system is also very difficult. And it is not only difficult for them, but also still a big barrier for the documented workers too, because even though there is a Thai policy, like education for all policy, but in practical, like, most of the migrant children, they cannot go to Thai education, Thai public school, because of the lack of documents. So in the informal factories, the migrant children, they also face the same experience. But unique is that since they, you know, since their wage they get is very small or very low amount, so it is very difficult for them to survive, you know, in this way. So another, you know, the method they find is like there are some migrant schools open by the diaspora communities, so which are open by the Burmese, and so instead of sending their children to the Thai public schools, migrant workers, they send their schools to the, you know, migrant schools opened by these diaspora communities. Also, like, instead of as going into the Thai hospitals, when they get sick, they rather go to the, like, medical clinic, which is opened by the, you know, which is intended for the migrant workers. So, yeah. They rather go to the, like, medical clinic rather than go into the Thai public hospitals.
And it's very interesting that you know, we were discussing earlier about the possibility of Burmese run businesses, and you're saying that there's not a lot of scope for that, but when it comes to Burmese run education and Burmese run healthcare, so not so much economic activity, but essential infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So it sounds from what you're saying that the Burmese have been able to make some significant inroads into providing at least that type of support network for their community.
Mm. Yeah, that is true. Like, these, like, infrastructures, like, you know, health and also the, you know, education opportunities for the migrant children, they are very important. And but I think these days, like, they are also facing, like, some difficulties too, because there is like a surge in anti-migrant sentiments from, you know, far right, you know, Thai groups. So we can also, like, see the news, like, the Thai authorities write down the, like, when, you know, labor organization, which is opened by Burmese citizens. So even though, like, these infrastructures are very important, very critically important, that to survive or, you know, to do their ongoing work is very also, you know, challenging, especially, like, in the context of the anti, you know, migrant sentiments against the workers. Yeah.
That's fascinating. And I mean, I hope that we can continue to do the work to uplift these communities and help them to establish the types of support networks that they need and help to provide them with the resources and the education that they need. But I think that our discussion today is going to help raise awareness of this and is going to help give people information that they need to be able to take action. So I want to thank you very much for coming on. I want to thank you for sharing these insights. But before we finish, and bearing in mind that we do have a pretty broad audience, and there may be people out there who do want to take action, who do want to raise awareness and achieve outcomes, if you have any message that you would like to spread directly, then I would invite you to share your thoughts now.
Maybe to the Thai citizens, to support the like labor activism and also to show your solidarity with the migrant workers from Myanmar. And also I think it is very important like to establish the international solidarity too, because the important thing to highlight is like when we criticize the like Thai economy, what we have to know is like there is just a like small number of group who are getting the benefits from this economy, but the majority of them are the working class and they are not benefiting from this business and the informal factories and other business activities. So it's very important to show your solidarity with the working class from Myanmar and to colonially support the labor activism.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Before we go, I want to call attention to a regular series we've been producing on this platform called Navigating a Minefield. The series was launched in response to the most recent Landmine Monitor report, which found that Myanmar has recorded the highest number of annual landmine casualties for the first time since reporting began. Navigating a Minefield centers on the people at greatest risk, as well as survivors of traumatic attacks, and features Burmese and international voices offering crucial context on landmine use and explosive remnants of war across the country. Produced in cooperation with our media and humanitarian partners, this series is intended to support risk education, raise awareness, and highlight our shared responsibility to end this ongoing threat to civilians. You can find more information about the episodes, along with risk education resources, on the Insight Myanmar website. Thank you again for listening and joining us in this effort to keep the focus on Myanmar and its people. Yarananga yaunya na da du ya danam biori ganeza de mana we gara besa yana besa yo ho ba yarananda da yananga na yarananya da yarananga poda ba yarananga no